Perhaps the creature Turner saw was still adapting from nighttime to day mode. Turner may have appeared like a blurry flash of light to the Bigfoot as it first tried to focus on the smooth-skinned human at close range, and then turned his whole head side to side to get a better look without the confusion of the eye membrane's glare. The observation of my own that I mentioned refers not to the eye of a Bigfoot, but to the eye of my very human son. He had surgery for a detached retina a few years ago, followed recently by another operation for cataracts, a very common complication of retinal surgery. Since then, his eye looks like it has a mirror reflecting from inside it whenever the light catches it just right. Sometimes it looks red, depending on the light that's hitting it, exactly as Turner described. The effect is due to an artificial lens implant with a special protective coating. The lens is a different part of the eye, of course, than where the tapetum lucidum should normally be found, but reflective membranes vary widely in structure between different classes of animals. Who's to say that over time, Bigfoot hasn't developed its own peculiar version of light magnification suited to its hunting needs? Whatever the explanation, this instance of a blinking, squinting Sasquatch brings me to a wonderful instance of synchronicity to close out this report. As I mentioned, Turner had started out that day aiming to find the grave of Alexander Robinson, or Chichipinqua. Translated, that name means the squinter, or blinking eye. Robinson was said to have had a facial tic, and just like the Sasquatch that Turner encountered, he was well known for constant squinting. Twice blessed. Amazingly, this encounter may actually have been Turner's second brush with Bigfoot. The first one occurred in 1960, when he was 12, in a different Chicago area public recreation area. It was in a forest preserve at Caldwell Woods, Turner told me, at 6380 West Devon Avenue. At that time, the park featured a gigantic toboggan run. Turner was there in the summer, however, playing softball with friends, when he had to jog to the nearby woods to retrieve a missed pitch. As I walked into the bushes, there was a figure like a gorilla, just sitting there like in a yoga position. Its hair was a dark reddish-brown, and it was expressionless, just looking at me. I went back and asked a friend to go take a look and see if he could see it too. He came right back and said he just saw the creature walking away. I have always thought how lucky I was to see this thing twice. Turner added that this creature had a more ape-like face that was more fully covered by hair than that of the creature at the Chichipinqua Preserve. And he says that almost 5 decades later, he still thinks about those two creatures every day and dreams about them at night as well. Encounter case summary. Bigfoot in Chicago. Reported creature or creatures. Two upright, Bigfoot-like creatures. Location, date. Schiller Park, Chicago, 1967, and Caldwell Woods Preserve, Chicago, 1960. Conditions. Summer, daylight, clear weather, close proximity in both incidents. Associated phenomena. The Oz factor, reported UFO very nearby in same week. Unexplained actions or appearance of creature. 1967 creature attacked witness with rocks and chased him a long distance to parking lot, refraining from catching witness. Creature also seemed to speak in a garbled language of some sort. Witness or witnesses. A young man, a.k.a. John Turner. Environmental factors. Long stretch of nature preserves followed the Des Plaines River through Chicago to provide water, good cover, and wildlife. Chapter 22. The Invisibles. North Carolina's Unseen Tracker. Nothing invites a heated discussion in the world of Bigfoot investigation like the question of whether Bigfoots can somehow make themselves invisible to the human eye. but this seems like a good place to focus on it for a moment. The animal that chased Turner seemed totally corporeal and alive, as we usually define that term, until the very end of the footpath chase. Only then did any question of its visibility come into possible play, and the witness allowed that it may have just taken a quick dive into the brush, a totally natural act. But consider the tale of another man pursued 3 years after Turner's incident in 1979 by a creature that never did bother to show itself physically. Ben Green, not his true name by request, told me in an interview in July 2014, "This has bothered me my whole life, and it's impossible to dismiss or forget. I'm a church person, and I can put my hand on the Bible and say that what I'm going to tell you is the truth." Green, now a school teacher who has also worked in city government management, was about 18 years old at the time and lived with his family 15 miles west of Charlotte, North Carolina, in a rural area near the Catawba River. The property was wooded, but as Green said, there was always a feeling of dread about the woods behind the house. Even at 1 p.m., those woods looked dark and inky. I would hunt and walk all over the woods about a mile from the river. My friend named Bobby wanted to come and hunt with me. I told him he could come and hunt, but he wouldn't see anything. There's no animals. No birds even fly over it. My mother and her sister wouldn't even look at the woods. Catawba people used to be there. People would hear things, sounds like a woman screaming in them. Strange poltergeist-like events even happened around his home, Green told me, with unseen forces doing things like throwing a 5-gallon bucket against the house. But one summer afternoon at about 1:30 p.m., Green recalls suggesting to Bobby that they take a walk to an area of power lines where there was a blackberry patch. "We walked along an old logging path where there was nothing growing," he said. And as they walked, they could hear someone, or something, walking on two legs behind them, keeping pace at a distance of 15 to 20 feet. Green said, "Bobby asked, 'Who is that?' We stopped. They stopped. But when we turned around and looked, nothing was there. Bobby was getting upset. I said, 'Bobby, let's get down to the power lines. We'll get there, cut into our left, then we can turn around and see what's there.'" They proceeded to follow Green's plan, but as if the invisible follower knew what they were intending to do, it also turned to its left and then walked around right in front of the two astonished young men. "We could hear the leaves crunching as it passed," said Green. "It was so close I could have reached out and touched it, but it was invisible. I had a thought of raising my gun, but I was like in a daze. It just kept on going." Green added that not only did he feel dazed, but that during the experience, the woods were dead silent, no sound of the creature breathing, no smell, bringing in the Oz factor once more. He also noted, "We both had rifles, and it didn't seem to matter. We, Bobby and I, were both dumbfounded. We were experiencing something that should not be. Whatever walked in front of us was big, because we could hear its footsteps as it walked 75 feet to a field. We didn't know what to do, and we were mentally and emotionally immobilized until we didn't hear it anymore." He and his family all suffered a variety of illnesses while living next to those woods, he said. And about the same time in 1979 that he and Bobby experienced the invisible tracker, Green and his mother witnessed a silver, spherical UFO around dusk one evening. "It was about 7:30 p.m. and was still light out," said Green. "We were at the windows hanging curtains, and we both saw the UFO flying by. It was a round silver ball, very bright, moving through the sky, probably a good mile away. It was not moving fast. You could easily follow it with your eyes. There was no contrail. I've never been able to determine the size, but it was probably a little bigger or the same size as the box trailer of a small U-Haul truck. It didn't wobble, spin, or dip. It just followed a trajectory, north to south, over the fields in an open area. We never told anyone. Years later, he asked a woman who had bought the place whether she ever had a bad feeling when she walked in those woods. She replied that she had seen a huge dark shape near the corner of her house when she pulled into the driveway one night that vanished as soon as she looked away. Another time, her daughter and a friend were sitting in the car parked in the driveway listening to music when they thought they saw something run past the car. When they went to look, they saw nothing but could hear the slapping sound of running feet. "I can tell you this," said Green. "There's something still in that woods. It has roughly a 4 to 5 mile range. You can't forget it. It's like it's always there." Green said he has sought the counsel of several clergy over this incident, hoping to get some sort of a handle on what that leaf cruncher may have been, but no minister has ever been able to explain the experience. "It was a life-changing experience," he said. "Even to this day, I don't live far, and I still don't like to go there." I'm not sure which part of this case is the most fascinating, the invisible creature or the spherical UFO. Let's start with the UFO. Although Green didn't report his case to any researchers or authorities, I still checked for any other UFO sightings in the area that year. There was one report, a very sensational one, that came from the small town of Monroe, about 15 miles southeast of Charlotte. It occurred in March, which would have been 3 to 5 months before Green's summer sighting. The witness, a car salesman named Pat Udy, lost 3 hours of time after seeing a very bright, oval-shaped light in the sky as he drove home at about 3 a.m. He said, astonishingly, "The only thing I remember is being on board a UFO and seeing an astronaut in a suit." According to an article by Monroe Inquirer-Journal reporter Henry Wells. Udy admitted to having 2 beers before the incident, but 2 beers weren't likely to have caused a major hallucination. He also said he was subjected to some kind of medical testing while inside the UFO, and that he believed the craft had picked up his entire car. His next memory was the sudden awareness of driving his car near his home, his eyes and skin burning and itching for no apparent reason. He did not report his sighting until 2 years later, however, so Ben Green wouldn't have even heard of it at the time of his own sighting. Udy's memories of what happened on board the craft were retrieved by hypnotic regression, but he said what he originally recalled about the sighting of the craft, the skin and eye discomfort, and the missing time, were all normal memories. It's tempting to wonder whether the alleged abduction was tall tale invented by Udy to avoid trouble with his wife, or perhaps the authorities for having those beers and being out so late. But he didn't seem to be in any sort of legal hot water over the incident. In addition, he didn't begin the hypnosis sessions or talk to a reporter until 2 years after the fact. He said that he waited so long to go public because he didn't want his automobile sales customers to see him as unreliable. Other than its geographical nearness to Charlotte, there aren't many similarities between Udy's sighting and Green's. The invisible walking thing that Green encountered in the woods was, of course, impossible to describe, much less linked to Udy's 5-foot humanoid entity wearing a light-colored metallic suit. Also, the craft Udy saw was oval rather than spherical. There were at least 9 other UFO sightings officially reported in North Carolina in 1979, but no others originated in the immediate vicinity of Charlotte, and the descriptions of those reported objects varied widely. This sort of disparity is normal for UFO reports everywhere, however. The most consistent thing about UFOs is the inconsistency of their descriptions. But the Udy event and other reports in the area show that there was significant UFO activity observed in North Carolina that year. The Greens were not alone. Military Vanishing Acts. That invisible creature on the logging trail was probably the more unusual of the 2 events Green experienced. There is no way to explain his experience by known science at present. Could it, however, have been some sort of covert technology possessed by our armed forces? That's probably the most common scenario people suggest to explain such things. While it may sound like something out of a conspiracy theory, this suggestion is not totally impossible. It's absolutely true, as mentioned earlier, that our military may now have limited access to early models of invisibility suits that work by bending light around objects. Such a cloak, made by using special nanotechnology, was developed at Purdue University in 2007, but couldn't work on anything except for large, non-moving items. It wouldn't have been effective at hiding a walking human or humanoid. Researchers have continued to advance the technology, though, with another big breakthrough occurring in 2014 at the University of Central Florida. Scientists at that institution invented a way to mass-produce the sophisticated materials required for efficient light bending, which means these cloaking devices may be in active use in the very near future. If Green's encounter had happened more recently, then the invisible walker might conceivably have been explained away as a soldier out on an experimental secret military exercise. But 36 years ago, that probably wouldn't have been the case. As usual, we are left to ponder what this thing might have been. Because it was invisible and didn't make vocalizations or leave indented footprints to examine, there's nothing to indicate that it was a cloaked Bigfoot or Dogman, a phantom human, nature spirit, or any other sort of detectable entity. The proximity of the invisible stalker to Green's UFO sighting makes it tempting to speculate that the creature may have been some type of extraterrestrial, ultra-terrestrial, or interdimensional alien. But with no witnessed connection between the two encounters, even this idea is mere conjecture. We simply have no way of knowing whether this thing merely needed a sweet UFO ride to get to the North Carolina woods. It's possible that invisibility may have been the walking thing's usual state. Before I get into that last thought, please know that Green's encounter with the Unseen Stepper is not a one-hit wonder. Next up is another report I've received of something equally unable to register within the light spectrum range of the human eye. Encounter case summary. North Carolina's unseen tracker. Reported creature or creatures. Unseen creature that appeared bipedal and made heavy footfalls, indicating physical weight. Location, date. Charlotte, North Carolina, 1979. Conditions, summer, daylight, clear weather. Associated phenomena. Sighting of a UFO, silver sphere moving smoothly through the sky about the same time in summer 1979 as strange creature appearance. Seen by Green and his mother at dusk, making a smooth, slow, even trajectory, with no contrail in a north-to-south direction over open fields. He estimated it was about the size of a U-Haul truck trailer and about a mile away. He did not report it to anyone. Also, Green experienced Oz factor conditions when the invisible creature passed by him. The family reported poltergeist-like activities around their home before Green's sighting. Unexplained actions or appearance of creature. Invisibility of creature as witnesses saw and heard the footprints appearing on the ground, but no apparent person or animal making them. Witness or witnesses. Two 18-year-old men. Environmental factors. Rural area featured dense, dark woods alongside an old logging trail in the vicinity of power lines, blackberry bushes, and the Catawba River, formerly the land of people of the Catawba tribe. Tennessee Clumsy Bigfoot. This report from folks who were followed by something heard but not seen arrived in 2012 from a family in a mountainous area near McMinnville in southeastern Tennessee. There are actually two major incidents to discuss. A more recent visit from a probable Bigfoot that left a few things behind, and an older encounter with the invisible what's it. I'll start with the more recent incident to help set the stage and to give some idea of what unusual things might be in the area. A man wrote to tell me his sister Rebecca had started noticing weird hollers coming from the woods near her mountainside property, making her dogs go crazy. After she and her husband hollered back one evening, they found evidence the next day that some large creature had been on the premises. It left several hairs in different colors, dark brown, light brown, and black, caught in the wood of a scaffolding structure and building project that stood over 6 feet off the ground. Rebecca, aged 44, talked with me by phone about the incident several times in more detail. The hair incident occurred in 2011 or 2012, she said. The scaffolding was up against a gazebo roof she was building at the time, next to a koi pond. She climbed up to find light brown hairs, some 7 inches long and some shorter and darker, wedged into the rough wood across an area she estimated as about 6 inches wider than an average human skull. The longer hairs were coarse, like a horse's, but had split ends on them, she added. She took pictures of them, but the hairs disappeared after they showed them to a private contractor who was working for them at the time. But there were also barefoot prints as long as a man's size 13 shoe and a flowering trumpet vine that had been denuded of its blossoms overnight. And as Rebecca continued to look around the yard, which was full of construction materials from work they were having done on the driveway, she discovered another strange thing. The something that visited her yard had evidently relieved itself and left a large amount of excrement inside and around some partially hollow cement blocks she had stacked nearby. The pile smelled terrible, she said, and had since become full of maggots. It looked as if the creature had used it just as a human uses a toilet, she said. She began to deduce what might have happened. My angel trumpet had 17 blooms on it, she said. It was 6 to 6.5 feet tall, and something stood and picked off every blossom and dropped them. I thought that this thing must have smelled them. And then when my dog barked, the thing ran out so fast it bumped its head on the scaffolding and then defecated on the way out. I was so scared I sat by the window for the next 2 nights. And by the way, she still has that cement block full of possible Bigfoot dew. I have spoken to a forensic veterinary lab to inquire about possible DNA analysis of the substance, but was told they wouldn't touch it due to the amount of likely deterioration caused by sitting in a shed for several years. The technician also told me that fecal matter is generally not great for analysis since it's largely composed of materials other than the animal's own tissue, except for a few cases in which the sample is very fresh and includes some of the creature's intestinal lining. With its element of humor, her story sounds almost like an episode cut from Harry and the Hendersons, a 1987 film about a family's accidental run-in with a Bigfoot. Could the trespasser have been a very awkward extraterrestrial? I checked as many online UFO records as I could find, but while New Fork reported 34 sightings in the 3 summer months of 2012 across the state of Tennessee, I didn't see any from McMinnville or its very close environs. That doesn't mean there weren't any, just no reports I could access. Rebecca and her family continue to wonder and watch the yard. Encounter case summary. Tennessee clumsy Bigfoot. Reported creature or creatures. Creature that left Bigfoot-like large footprints, tall enough to bump head on gazebo scaffold beam, hairy enough to leave 7-inch tuft, and large enough to fill concrete block with excrement visited yard at night. Location, date. McMinnville in southeastern Tennessee, summer 2012. Conditions. Clear, warm weather, but creature was not directly seen. Associated phenomena. Screams had been heard from wooded hollow previous to incident. Also, the property owner's dogs were extremely and very unusually agitated that entire night. I searched UFO databases for the area near McMinnville during the summer nights of 2012 and didn't find anything within about a 25-mile radius. I didn't have specific dates to search for moon phases or solar flares. Unexplained actions or appearance of creature. Unusual signs of large animal visitation in yard, including excrement left inside a hollow concrete block. Witness or witnesses. A husband and wife discovered evidence left in yard. Environmental factors. The home was within 2 miles of logging trails, a wooded area of varied elevations, site of old church and graveyard very near. Area is famous for lengthy and vast caves. No-see-um Tennessee Mountain Monster. The older incident Rebecca experienced is a bit more chilling than the yard visit. It dates from 1997 or 1998, when Rebecca was in her late 20s, and happened on a property just 2 miles from her present home, in the same area of forested mountainside. This property was also surrounded by woods and near an old church and graveyard. Rebecca and three companions, one female and two males, were riding along a rough logging road in a Ford Bronco when they had a problem with the vehicle and had to walk 2 miles on foot to get back out. The two males were walking together in front, and Rebecca and her female friend were lagging behind them, chatting. Suddenly, they heard the footsteps of some type of animal rushing toward them. "We heard it first at about 4 to 5 feet behind us," she said. "It sounded like a dog panting and running at a pace." Her first thought was that it must be a coyote, but whatever it was ran right through the middle of the small group and kept on going, although they could see absolutely nothing. "It was like you could feel the energy," she added. They were left standing there staring at one another, trying to figure out whether they had all really just had the same experience. If it had been just one person experiencing the presence of something not seen, most people would tend to chalk it up to either imagination or misidentification of other forest sounds. Looking at this case and the separate incident we looked at just before, however, it's difficult to understand how two or four people might simultaneously imagine that an invisible creature was walking near them. As we've noted earlier, people do not share true hallucinations. What might it have been? It's tempting to think it may have been a cloaked Bigfoot, since it seems there is presently at least one rather clumsy squatch living within a mile in those same woods just a couple of decades later. But with absolutely no other corroborating evidence, there's no way to say. It could just as well have been a couple of Christian pages and visible dwarves. All we can conclude is that Rebecca lives in an area of the highest strangeness. Encounter case summary. No-see-um Tennessee Mountain Monster. Reported creature or creatures. Invisible creature heard and felt running through forest and past witnesses. Location, date. McMinnville in southeastern Tennessee, summer 1997 or 1998. Conditions, clear weather, daylight. Witnesses on foot on a logging trail through wooded area. Associated phenomena. Nearby area where Rebecca heard disembodied voices passing overhead outdoors and where screams have been heard at nighttime. Although Tennessee has had frequent UFO reports for decades, I found no reports in or near McMinnville for the spring, summer, or fall months of 1997 or 1998. I did find one for 1995. Dates weren't available to pinpoint moon stages or solar flare activity. Unexplained actions or appearance of creature. Invisibility of animal, despite sounds and other perceptions of its presence near the witnesses. Witness or witnesses. Two males and two females. Environmental factors. Logging trail, wooded area. Site of old church and graveyard very near. area is famous for lengthy and vast caves. Chapter 23. When Worlds Collide. The previous chapter dealt with several situations where multiple witnesses perceived a seemingly impossible thing, the nearby movement of physical but invisible creatures. Most people would assume that this points to something paranormal. To quote Gershwin's Porgy and Bess, it ain't necessarily so. Thanks to recent scientific research, it's now feasible to believe there could have been an actual physical entity running through the woods that, for some reason, was able to change or refract the light around its body in a way that thwarts human sight. Since the experimental technology to do this in a lab already exists, the physics of this talent lies squarely in the realm of possibility. The question is whether there actually are physical animals with a natural ability to refract light. Polar bears might come close. Their transparent, hollow hairs scatter infrared light so that their coats can trap body warmth. But although that helps them stay warm and blend in with the snow around them, it doesn't make them completely invisible to the human eye. Just because polar bears aren't quite there yet, some researchers believe Bigfoot may have taken that next step to grow its own invisibility cloak. Researcher M.K. Davis posted a May 26, 2015 YouTube video explaining the unique qualities of a tuft of alleged Bigfoot hair the submitter said was found in an active sightings area. Davis said he was surprised, upon microscopic observation of the tuft, to see several different types of hair structure distributed within the sample. Davis said in the video, there were different colors, different textures, different levels of transparency from completely opaque to almost invisible, like glass. And it just struck me as being extremely odd. Davis shares slides of the enlarged views of these hairs and explains that the variety of colors and opacities might result in light refraction powerful enough to cause an eyewitness to lose sight of it entirely. And indeed, one slide shows an entirely transparent shaft caught in the act of refracting, bending, light so that it creates a lens flare. I can imagine that if this refraction flare were to occur over an entire animal, it could definitely affect human perception of that creature. It would be like the ultimate camo, says Davis. It could possibly disappear right in front of your eyes, even though it's still there, and even though you're looking at it. I'm personally more and more interested in this idea of a physical animal that can turn invisible or cloak itself when it wants to go to stealth mode. It's hard to see why cloaking would be necessary for any normal predator, however. Taking the two earlier incidents as examples, the hikers in each case were surrounded by forests, perfectly capable of providing dense cover. It's almost as if the creature were either showing off its marvelous skill, or perhaps it was somehow in a literal world of its own, so that it wasn't even aware of the hikers. Either possibility would be paradigm-shattering. Land spirits and fairy paths. Perhaps the answer has more to do with the location than the entity. In both of these invisible creature cases, the witnesses were walking along old logging trails. These are usually straight paths cut into forest to create the easiest transport routes. They remind me of the ancient straight fairy paths of the British Isles and Europe, of which Paul Devereux says in Fairy Paths and Spirit Roads, country hobmen or land spirits haunted wild, uncultivated locations. That describes the areas inhabited by our invisibles very well. Devereux added that these spirits could take many forms, canines, satyrs, humanoids, and more, but shared the same characteristics and abilities in whatever shape they assumed. They had superhuman powers such as flight, invisibility, emphasis mine, and shape-shifting, said Devereux. As the 17th century Scottish minister and collector of fairy lore Robert Kirk put it, their bodies of congealed air are sometimes carried aloft, other wiles grovel in different shapes. They could also take, emphasis mine, that is, abduct, mortals, whisking them off to fairyland, never to be seen again, or lead them astray out into the night. Again, I think of Christian Page and how fortunate he was to make it home from that Quebec cornfield. The fairy paths could be above ground, below it, or on the earth, added Devereaux. An above-ground fairy path might also correspond to today's UFO paths, and Devereaux's reference to abductions also seems connected to modern-day UFO encounters. According to Devereaux and various sources, land spirits, such as those described earlier, were extremely territorial and also curious about people who entered their domain, especially those who used their paths. Devereaux made the point that these spirits were not confined to the British Isles and Europe, but are found in the legends and folklore of people around the world. He links British and Celtic fairy paths to German Geisterwege, ghost or spirit ways, and Dutch Spokenwegen, spook ways, and finds similar pathways such as the ancient straight paths of the Miwok trails in the California Sierras, and in other Native American traditions as well. Some of these include those made by the mysterious Anasazi people of Chaco Canyon, New Mexico, and the 60-mile straight track constructed by Ohio's Hopewell people. Devereaux asks the natural question, what is it about straight paths that might connect them to invisible yet physically palpable spirits? And he answers that question with one word, shamanism. He says that the deep source was shamanism is fairly certain. This is supported by the fact that virtually all straight road and line features are located in the territories of people known to have practiced shamanism and were built and used at the height of those cultures. Shamans are almost universally believed to fly or run via their spirit bodies in straight lines. And the McMinnville invisible creature did walk straight through the group of four hikers without so much as begging their pardon. As usual, there's simply no way to say whether it was a physical creature with its own fur cloak, something we might dub traditional magic, or a quick brush with a spot where the veil between our world and some other had grown thin enough to ooze monsters. But let's take a closer look at that last idea. Chapter 24. Possibly Portals. Kentucky Sky Castle. Researcher and author Barton Nunnally, a lifelong resident of Kentucky, is well known for his books Mysterious Kentucky and The Inhumanoids. Both display his great knowledge of and experience with anomalous creatures and phenomena of all kinds. A surprising amount of his expertise stems from personal experiences with these things, including a very clear look in 1975 at what most people might consider a classic portal. Barton was only 9 years old, but his 10-year-old brother Dean also witnessed the startling sight as they traveled with their family on a gravel lane called Mound Ridge Road. What the two brothers saw from the back seat of their car so deeply impressed Nunnally that he remembers the entire incident in great detail many decades later. He recounted it in Mysterious Kentucky. Returning to their rural home from a trip to the store, the family had been on the road only a few minutes when the younger Nunnally spotted a large cloud mass above some trees. The center of the mass began to swirl and move out and away to reveal a round hole, inside of which sat what looked like a brick castle, complete with turrets and a red banner flapping in the breeze. He could even see an iron-reinforced door inside the hole. Nunnally mentioned several times that the castle appeared every bit as solid and real as anything in their normal field of vision. He gestured to his brother, who then also spotted it. The two stared in amazement for a few seconds until a group of tall trees momentarily blocked their view, and by the time they could see the cloud again, it had returned to its normal state, to their great disappointment. Nunnally said of this incident in a recent phone discussion that he was so excited at the amazing thing he and his brother had seen that he told his schoolmates all about it. That didn't go well. Despite the ridicule he then had to endure, he has never wavered on the reality of his experience. And as an adult, he said, no one has dared accuse me to my face of lying about it. The image within the hole in the cloud sounds very much like a European medieval castle, right down to the red banner. It's very unlikely such a castle ever existed near Henderson, Kentucky, and surely not along that stretch of road. There's absolutely no explanation for the boy's experience in terms of our known physical world. Nunnally was also sure that it wasn't a shared hallucination. And as a 9-year-old, he probably didn't realize that his sighting had much in common with the type of phenomenon that's been described in human experience from ancient times to the present, although it may go by different names and be understood in different ways. What the Nunnally brothers saw was in some ways like a classic religious vision, which often entails a panorama set above the viewer in thin air, without anything necessarily entering or exiting. Of course, there were a few moments when the brick castle with its flowing pennants disappeared from view, and for all they knew, anything might have emerged from the castle in the clouds during that time. According to Nunnally, this area of Kentucky has long harbored many different types of strange creatures and oddball entities. Few places can compare to Henderson County when it comes to anomalous activity, notes Nunnally in Mysterious Kentucky. In that book, he documents scores of strange reports of huge bipedal furry beasts, goatmen, the infamous humanoid known as the Spotsville Monster, UFOs, and lake monsters. Perhaps some can be attributed to mere folklore or legend, but where are all the rest coming from? Probably not Illinois or other neighboring states. Portals could explain a lot. Problems with portals. The term portal is familiar to most people these days, partly because it has found so many contemporary uses in computer terminology, fantasy gaming, and many other areas unrelated to metaphysical transport. We now not only accept, but expect portals, wormholes, UFOs, strange lights, and humanoid figures in works of fantasy and science fiction, to the point where we barely blink when a DeLorean turns into a time machine, or a vampire named Angel, in Joss Whedon's TV series by the same name, dives into a world of thick-headed demons where song is unknown and the contemporary dance moves are horrible. But aside from actual sightings of portals like those of the Nunnally brothers or the rancher's observations of orange structures on Skinwalker Ranch, the idea of doors in the world, as Michael Swords calls them, has become sort of a one-size-fits-all means of explaining sudden appearances and disappearances of cryptids, UFOs, fairy folk, phantoms of all kinds, and even human beings. Something unidentifiable pops out of nowhere? It must have come from a portal. Another weird thing disappears mysteriously? It obviously hopped into a portal. I'm certainly not against considering alternative explanations for anomalous phenomena or cryptid animals, which many already consider alternative topics in their own right. But it's a dicey practice, in my opinion, to explain one mysterious anomaly with another without some reason. That's classic circular logic. Double the circles and minus the logic. And while physicists now say science and math show portals can definitely exist, we still have no proof as to where the portals originate or where they go, if they do in fact go anywhere at all, or even if they take passengers. In that case, why not just throw the reports and encounters suggesting transworld transport in yet another X-file and consider them permanently unsolved, perhaps even taboo? That is the usual final judgment on events that defy the normal order of things. Call me a Fox Mulder wannabe, but I usually prefer to risk considering the extra mundane, if for no other reason than to rule it out. One thing I learned as a newspaper reporter was that it was a mistake to ignore certain lines of inquiry simply because I thought them unlikely. All too often, I would end up wishing I had at least taken the time to check those other possibilities. In the case of portals, it's only in very recent history that scientific knowledge has grown to the point where a notion such as a wormhole connecting two worlds will even be brought up in professional circles. And yet, ancient texts, legends, and folklore have mentioned similar things for millennia. If there is any substance to the idea of invisible doorways between our world and others, clues and patterns to their locations and natures must exist somewhere in the jumble of legend, lore, and scientific theory recorded about them. And the scientific understanding of their workings grows yearly. Physicists are currently toiling to create teleportation devices, or technological portals, that may someday allow us to push a button and command a machine to energize, just as it did the crews of Star Trek's USS Enterprise in every film and TV episode of that long-running series. Again, we find that word quantum tossed into the fray. The headline for a 2012 article on the PHYS.org website proclaimed, "Physicists Break Quantum Teleportation Distance." The experiment involved satellite teleportation of information rather than matter, but was considered by those involved to be a significant step in the development of teleportation technology. The article quotes physicist Anton Zeilinger, "Our experiment shows how mature quantum technologies are today, and how useful they can be for practical applications." Portals of the Ancients and Gateways to Heaven. Multi-world transitions of the body and or spirit are a common theme in the Bible and in sacred literature of other religions. Saints are taken to heaven, and divine beings come into the earthly plane to bestow commandments and the tools of civilization, while angels and demons shuttle to and from earth. It's not an easy commute. Places like heaven, hell, Valhalla, and the River Styx aren't reachable by car or by any known airliner, cruise ship, or space capsule. It's not surprising, then, that religious writings and world mythology often include instances of unusual transport, whether by external or internal means. The Bible, to look at just one ancient source of the many possible, includes numerous instances of people and things appearing and disappearing overhead. The transports usually bridge earth and the heavens. Often these events are labeled visions, but that doesn't mean they were dreams, hallucinations, or all in the holy men's heads. At least one dictionary of biblical terms defines a vision as a vivid apparition, not a dream. And an apparition, in turn, is something that appears of its own volition from an unknown source. Ghosts, for instance. But biblical visions were believed to be actual communications from God and heaven, a place that modern minds might interpret as another reality. Author Ken Garrison goes beyond that to suggest the ancient lands of the Bible may be one big natural portal area where it's easier for couplings between heaven and earth to occur. Garrison's book, Israel, God's Interdimensional Portal, is socio-political in its nature, but he has assembled an impressive list of biblical examples that suggest this thinning of the veil between worlds exists, and that men and various other creatures have at times been able to travel between realms. Elijah's Whirlwind. One of the best-known biblical examples of heavenly transportation is that of the prophet Elijah, who was taken skyward one day in a most unusual manner, as he and his disciple Elisha traveled on foot from Gilgal to Bethel in the northern kingdom of Israel. As the Old Testament tells it in Kings 2, chapter 2, the two men were first separated on the road by a bright vessel described as a burning chariot drawn by horses of fire. Some theorists who believe man's early history was guided and abetted by ancient extraterrestrials have proposed this astonishing conveyance may actually have been an alien craft, or UFO, described in imagery appropriate to the technological level of that age, mid to late 800s BCE. Elijah was then borne aloft in a whirlwind, a meteorological phenomenon that might also be described as a spinning funnel or a column of air, but is not the same thing as a tornado. Tornadoes are spawned by storm clouds, are generally much more powerful than whirlwinds, and reach all the way from the clouds to the ground. A normal whirlwind, then, would not be expected to carry a man away, and yet Elijah was never seen again, although 50 men set out to search for him in case the whirlwind had deposited him somewhere in the vicinity. I doubt that Elisha expected Elijah to be found, as the idea of this passage was that Elijah was to be taken directly to heaven by God. The Bible tells us that both Elijah and Elisha were expecting this to happen. Elijah promised Elisha that if he was able to see him being taken, hinting that Elijah knew this was not going to be an ordinary passing visible to most people, that Elisha would inherit Elijah's place as prophet. Elisha not only witnessed the whole thing, he retrieved Elijah's cloak that dropped to the ground as the prophet disappeared above him. Ezekiel's creatures in the cloud. Ezekiel, another Old Testament prophet, also saw a skyward spectacle around 600 BCE, as he camped with a group of exiles near Babylon. Ezekiel described what he saw as visions of God that began with the sight of a windstorm, or great cloud, encompassed by bright light. At its center glowed bright metallic material reminiscent of the chariot that parted Elijah from Elisha. And inside that center were four unknown living creatures that, counterintuitively, also appeared to be made of fiery metal. The creatures had multiple faces, eyes, wings, and wheels that many modern interpreters have likened to some type of machine. And they attended what Ezekiel interpreted as the throne of God. All of this took place under a vast expanse of beautiful lights, metals, and crystalline substances that were very unearth-like. Ezekiel's interaction with this remarkable and stunning vision in the center of the brilliant cloud and its meaning has been written about, interpreted, and discussed throughout the ages. Its symbolism and possible meanings are complex and fascinating. For our purposes here, however, the main thing is that it's yet another example of clouds that open in the sky and either take things in, reveal things inside, or send things out. By things, I mean people, creatures, castles, machines, unknown objects, and otherworldly environments. Believers in the Old Testament consider this to have been a holy event, of course, but it supports the widespread human belief in the concept that such a gateway in the sky, especially with a connection to stormy or unusual clouds, can exist. And where there's belief, after all, there's usually some true event or knowledge behind that belief. Saint Cuthbert's Vision. The Scottish Bishop of Hexham and Prior of Lindisfarne, known today as Saint Cuthbert, was famous during his lifetime for many miracles and healings. He once prayed for food for hungry followers, for example, and almost immediately a massive eagle carrying a huge salmon landed right in front of him and surrendered its meal. Cuthbert did not forget to return to the eagle its share. He may be best known, however, for the waking vision he experienced as a young man tending a herd of sheep. On August 31st, 651 CE, Cuthbert sat praying, as he usually did during the night watch, when a sudden bright light in the sky drew his attention. There, the astonished shepherd witnessed a company of angels busy at some heavenly task. According to the story of Cuthbert's life, as written by the English monk known as the Venerable Bede, Cuthbert testified, "Behold, whilst I was awake and praying during a moderate portion of the night, I saw such great miracles of God. The door of heaven was opened, and there was led in thither, amidst an angelic company, the spirit of some holy man, who now, forever blessed, beholds the glory of the heavenly mansion, and Christ its King, whilst we still grovel amid this earthly darkness. And I think it must have been some holy bishop, or some favored one from out of the company of the faithful, whom I saw thus carried into heaven, amid so much splendor by that large angelic choir." As it turned out, Cuthbert discovered the next day that a nearby bishop, later canonized as St. Aidan, had died on the nearby Isle of Lindisfarne, at the same time as his vision. It seemed Cuthbert had seen nothing less than the spirit of the bishop whisked off to his eternal reward. There are many more such accounts in all types of religious writings and literature throughout the world, enough to easily fill their own large book. But as I searched for other examples of visible portals, it seemed that there were far more things going into portals than there were things coming out. My interests in this book, of course, lie with the latter type of incidents. With that in mind, it's time to revisit that field in Wisconsin. Chapter 25. Search for a Wisconsin Portal. Back to Smith's Field. I described in the introduction to this book the peculiar event in January 2014, when something apparently dropped into the middle of a snowy field and then walked 1/4 mile to the woods in what looked like a bipedal posture, leaving property owner Roy Smith a trackway of 2 1/2 inch by 4 1/2 inch unidentifiable prints as evidence. "Whatever this is, it was dropped," he said. "What could it possibly be?" In a situation like this, it really is tempting to leave the known world behind and turn to the idea of a portal, wormhole, UFO, or interdimensional vortex. I admit, I did. And as we've mentioned earlier, people have claimed to see these doors between realities. Given the continuing parade of odd photos, prints, and carcass depredation on his land, Smith had begun to wonder if such a thing as an interdimensional portal could be the answer. Other strange events had continued that January and then on into what would be a very harsh cold winter as Smith continued to watch his field closely for new signs of predator activity or unexplained animal tracks or lights. In one case, remains of a large deer carcass were dragged overnight into an adjoining field and returned to Smith's field, reduced to a completely stripped but whole skeleton, the next night. More odd forms of anomalous lights began to show up on the trail cams, night and day, and the thick, obscuring mist reappeared again and again to hide the perpetrator whenever new and interesting changes occurred in the field. Except for those times, all three trail cams functioned perfectly, showing coyotes, turkey buzzards, skunks, and other normal predators going about their usual business in that rural habitat. I feel the things that have been going on in my hayfield are not explainable with traditional physics, Smith finally told me. The events of January 3, 2014 were a great example. The Orange Light Structure. You may recall that I also mentioned in the introduction the fact that Smith found about 30 photographs on his Primos trail cam that had been taken that morning of January 3rd between 7 a.m., not long after sunrise, and almost 7:30 a.m. A Moultrie camera, fastened to the same post, wasn't triggered, although both cameras were aimed directly north at the section of Smith's tree line that seemed to attract the most unusual activity and was now covered in snow. The Primos took pictures every 20 seconds during daylight, and by 7:25 a.m., the retrieved photos had begun to show a soft, orangey mist forming in a roughly oval shape in the small tree directly over the remains of a deer carcass that had lain there for some weeks. As minutes passed, the soft, translucent oval of mist in the tree began to slowly condense, deepen, and brighten. The rising sun to the east cast a